Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 231. It's Monday, October 9th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Let's get started with a somewhat scary story on how many years diabetes can rob us of, particularly if diagnosed young. This from Medical Express. Type 2 diabetes diagnosis at age 30 can reduce life expectancy by up to 14 years, warn experts. Even people who do not develop the condition until later in life, with a diagnosis at age 50 years, could see their life expectancy fall by up to 6 years, an analysis of data from 19 high-income countries found. Increasing levels of obesity, poor diet, and increased sedentary behavior are driving a rapid rise in the number of cases of type 2 diabetes worldwide. In 2021, 537 million adults worldwide were estimated to have diabetes, with an increasing number diagnosed at younger ages. Using data from the U.S. population, it was estimated that individuals with type 2 diabetes diagnosed at age 30, 40, and 50 years died on average about 14, 10, or 6 years earlier, respectively, than individuals without the condition. These estimates were slightly higher in women at 16 years, 11 years, and 7 years diagnosed at either 30, 40, or 50 than they were in men at 14, 9, and 5 years, respectively. Okay, so that's a lot of numbers, but what really strikes me is that, okay, so you look at a more typical in the past diagnosis of diabetes at age 50. If you bump that 20 years earlier to age 30, then men lose an 8 additional years lost, and women lose 9 additional years of life. So the thing is, so getting a diagnosis 20 years earlier takes away 8 or 9 of those 20 years that you have between the age 30 and 50. So that's very stunning. So it really shows that that early onset is associated with a lot of health problems and an early death. Very scary. Okay, well, for better or worse, that's a perfect introduction to the next two stories, which are based on a years-long study by the Washington Post entitled "An Epidemic of Chronic Illness is Killing Us Too." And there's a second story that follows this that compares Ashtabula in Ohio with a similar city in Pennsylvania and New York, showing that Ohio, unfortunately, is doing worse. So, this is America's life expectancy crisis, study by the Washington Post. The United States is failing at a fundamental mission, keeping people alive. After decades of progress, life expectancy, long regarded as a singular benchmark of a nation's success, peaked in 2014 at 78.9 years, then drifted downward even before the coronavirus pandemic. Among wealthy nations, the United States in recent decades went from the middle of the pack to being an outlier, and it continues to fall further and further behind. A year-long Washington Post examination reveals that this erosion in life span is deeper and broader than widely recognized, afflicting a far-reaching swath of the United States. While opioids and gun violence have rightly seized the public's attention, stealing hundreds of thousands of lives, chronic diseases are the greatest threat, killing far more people between ages 35 and 64 every year. Heart disease and cancer remained, even at the height of the pandemic, the leading causes of death for people 35 to 64. and many other conditions, private tragedies that unfold in tens of millions of U.S. households have become more common, including diabetes and liver disease. These chronic ailments are the primary reason American life expectancy has been poor compared with other nations. Sickness and death are scarring entire communities in much of the country. The geographical footprint of early death is vast. In a quarter of the nation's counties, mostly in the South and Midwest, working-age people are dying at a higher rate than 40 years ago. The trail of death is so prevalent that a person could go from Virginia to Louisiana and then up to Kansas by traveling entirely within counties where death rates were higher than they were when Jimmy Carter was president. Deaths of adults aged 35 to 64 are concentrated in the nation's interior, including Appalachia, the Mississippi Delta, and parts of the Midwest. In recent decades, death rates have been rising in the interior while declining in coastal regions. This phenomenon is exacerbated by the country's economic, political, and racial divides. America is increasingly a country of haves and have-nots, measured not just by bank accounts and property values, but also by vital signs and grave markers. Dying prematurely, the Post found, has become the most telling measure of the nation's growing inequality. The mortality crisis did not flare overnight. It has developed over decades, with early deaths an extreme manifestation of an underlying deterioration of health and a failure of the health system to respond. COVID highlighted this for all the world to see. It killed far more people per capita in the United States than in any other wealthy nation. The Post compared death rates for people living in the poorest 10% of counties to people living in the wealthiest 10% of counties over the past four decades. In that time, the gap between rich and poor death rates grew significantly wider, with rich communities' death rates improving for many years, while poor areas largely stayed the same and then worsened. Death rates also grew many times faster than the difference in income between the poorest and richest areas. In the early 1980s, people in the poorest areas were 9% more likely to die each year, with 88 more deaths per 100,000 people than their wealthy counterparts. That gap has widened significantly over time. By the year 2000, the death rate gap had grown so that people in the poorest areas were 27% more likely to die each year. By 2015, the people in the poorest areas were 49% more likely to die each year. Chronic conditions thrive in a sink-or-swim culture, with the U.S. government spending far less than peer countries on preventive medicine and social welfare generally. Breakthroughs in technology, medicine, nutrition that should be boosting average lifespans have instead been overwhelmed by poverty, racism, distrust of the medical system, fracturing of social networks, and unhealthy diets built around highly processed foods, researchers said. The calamity of chronic disease is the not-so-silent pandemic, said Marcella Nunez-Smith, a professor of medicine, public health, and management at Yale University. This is fundamentally a threat to our society. But chronic diseases, she said, don't spark the sense of urgency among national leaders and the public that a novel virus did. America's medical system is unsurpassed when it comes to treating the most desperately sick people, said William Cook, a doctor who tends to patients in the town of Austin, Indiana. But growing healthy people to begin with were the worst in the world, he said. If we came in last at the next Olympics, imagine what we would do. And I would like to provide a little bit of context. This is an excellent report, but this is one where I think they missed it, at least with this quote of one doctor. America's medical system is unsurpassed. I think that's a little bit overstated, unless you define the most desperately sick people as a small group of people who happen to get treated. But if you look at all the people who are desperately sick, there's a lot of people who are not treated. So if you look at it as a whole among desperately sick people, we actually are surpassed, unfortunately, by most of our peers of so-called developed countries. Okay, on with the story. The Post interviewed scores of clinicians, patients, and researchers and analyzed county-level death records for the past five decades. The data analysis concentrated on people 35 to 64 because these ages have the greatest number of excess deaths compared with peer nations. What emerges is a dismaying picture of a complicated, often bewildering health system that is overmatched by the nation's burden of disease. Chronic illnesses, which often sicken people in middle age after the protective vitality of youth has ebbed, erase more than twice as many years of life among people younger than 65 as all the overdoses, homicides, suicides, and motor vehicle injuries combined, the Post found. The best barometer of rising inequality in America is no longer income. It is life itself. Wealth inequality in America is growing, but the Post found that the death gap, the difference in life expectancy between the affluent and impoverished communities, has been widening many times faster. In the early 1980s, people in the poorest communities were 9% more likely to die each year, but the gap grew to 49% in the past decade and widened to 61% when COVID struck. Lifespans in the richest communities in America have kept inching upward, but lag far behind comparable areas in Canada, France, and Japan, and the gap is widening. The same divergence is seen at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. People living in the poorest areas of America have far lower life expectancy than people in the poorest areas of other countries reviewed. 40 years ago, small towns and rural regions were healthier for adults in the prime of life. The reverse is now true. Urban death rates have declined sharply, while rates outside the country's largest metro areas flattened and then rose. Just before the pandemic, adults aged 35 to 64 in the most rural areas were 45% more likely to die each year than people in the largest urban centers. The big-ticket items are cardiovascular diseases and cancer, said Arlene Geronimus, a University of Michigan professor who studies population health equity, but people always instead go to homicide, opioid addiction, HIV. Tobacco looms large in this sad story. One of the signal successes of public health in the past half century has been the drop in smoking rates and associated declines in lung cancer and cardiovascular disease. But roughly 1 in 7 middle-aged Americans still smokes, according to the CDC. In 1900, life expectancy at birth in the United States was 47 years. Infectious diseases routinely claimed babies in the cradle. Diseases were essentially incurable except through the wiles of the human immune system, of which doctors had a minimal understanding. Then came a century that saw life expectancy soar beyond the biblical standard of, quote, 70 years and 10. New tools against disease included antibiotics, insulin, and vaccines. Public health efforts improved sanitation and the water supply. Social Security and Medicare eased poverty and sickness in the elderly. The rise of life expectancy became the ultimate proof of societal progress in the 20th century of America. Decade by decade, the number kept climbing, and by 2010, the country appeared to be marching inexorably toward the milestone of 80 years. It never got there. Partly that is a reflection of how the United States approaches health. This is a country where we think health and medicine are the same thing, said Elena Marks, former health and environmental policy director for the city of Houston. The nation built a health industrial complex, she said, that costs trillions of dollars, yet underachieves. We have undying faith in big new technology and a drug for everything. Access to as many MRIs as our hearts desire, said Marks, a senior health policy fellow at Rice University's Institute for Public Policy. 80+% of health outcomes are determined by non-medical factors, and yet we're on this train and we're going to keep going. The opioid epidemic, a uniquely American catastrophe, is one factor in the widening gap between the United States and peer nations. Others include high rates of gun violence, suicides, and car accidents. That is, motor vehicle injuries. In public health, we don't really believe in accidents. There are causes for things that can potentially be prevented. But some chronic diseases, obesity, liver disease, hypertension, kidney disease, and diabetes were also on the rise among people aged 35 to 64 and played an underappreciated role in the pre-pandemic erosion of lifespans. Then COVID hit. In 2021, according to the CDC, life expectancy cratered, reaching 76.4 years, the lowest since the mid-1990s. The pandemic amplified a racial gap in life expectancy that had been narrowing in recent decades. In 2021, life expectancy for Native Americans was 65 years, for Black Americans, 71, for White Americans, 76, for Hispanic Americans, 78, and for Asian Americans, 84. Death rates decreased in 2022 because of the pandemic's easing, and when life expectancy data for 2022 is finalized this fall, it is expected to show a partial rebound, according to the CDC, but the country is still trying to dig out of a huge mortality hole. For more than a decade, academic researchers have disgorged stacks of reports on eroding life expectancy. A seminal 2013 report from the National Research Council entitled Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, lamented America's decline among peer nations. It's that feeling of the bus heading for the cliff and nobody seems to care, said Stephen Wolf, a Virginia Commonwealth University professor and co-editor of the 2013 report. In 2015, Princeton University economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton garnered national headlines with a study on rising death rates among white Americans in midlife, which they linked to the marginalization of people without a college degree and to, quote, deaths of despair. The grim statistics are there for all to see, and yet the political establishment has largely skirted the issue. We describe it, we lament it, we sort of accepted it, said Derek Griffin, director of Georgetown University's Center for Men's Health Equity. Nobody's outraged about us having shorter life expectancy. It can be a confusing statistic. Life expectancy is a wide-angle snapshot of average death rates for people in different places or age groups. It is typically expressed as life expectancy at birth, but the number does not cling to a person from the cradle as if it were a prediction. And if a country has an average life expectancy at birth of 79 years, that doesn't mean a 78-year-old has only a year to live. However confusing it may be, the life expectancy metric is a reasonably good measure of a nation's overall health, and America is not very good. Death in densely populated areas have dropped below others. Death rates for age 35 to 64 were broadly similar four decades ago, whether in densely packed urban areas or in rural America. But in the 1990s, rural residents began dying at sharply higher rates than their counterparts in urban regions. And then there's the rampant disease that's impossible to miss, obesity. Today, the average man in the United States weighs about 200 pounds. Women on average weigh about 171 pounds, roughly what men weighed in the 1960s. In 1990, almost 12% of adults in America were obese. Now that figure is 42%. The rate of obesity deaths for adults 35 to 64 doubled from 1979 to 2000, then doubled again from 2000 to 2019. In 2005, a special report in the New England Journal of Medicine warned that the rise of obesity would eventually halt and reverse historical trends in life expectancy. That generated little reaction. Obesity is one reason progress against heart disease, after accelerating between 1980 and 2000, has slowed, experts say. Obesity is poised to overtake tobacco as the number one preventable cause of cancer, according to Otis Brawley, an oncologist and epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. What happened to this country to enfeeble it so? There is no singular explanation. It's not just the stress that is such a constant feature of daily life, weathering bodies at a microscopic level, or the abundance of high fructose corn syrup in a 44-ounce cup of soda. Instead, experts studying the mortality crisis say any plan to restore American vigor will have to look not merely at the specific things that kill people, but at the causes of illness and death, including social factors. Poor life expectancy, in this view, is the predictable result of the society we have created and tolerated, one riddled with lethal elements such as inadequate insurance, minimal preventive care, bad diets, and a weak economic safety net. There's a great deal of harm in the way that we somehow stigmatize social determinants, like that's code for poor, people of color or something, said Nunez Smith, Associate Dean for Health Equity Research at Yale. And while that risk is not shared evenly, she said, everyone is at risk of not having these basic needs met. Rachel Levine, Assistant Secretary for Health in the Department of Health and Human Services, said in an interview that an administration priority is reducing health disparities highlighted by the pandemic. It's foundational to everything we are doing. It's not like we do health equity on Friday afternoon. Levine, a pediatrician, pointed to the opioid crisis and lack of universal health coverage as reasons the United States lags peer nations in life expectancy. She emphasized efforts by the Biden administration to improve health trends, including a major campaign to combat cancer and a long-term multi-agency plan to bolster health and resilience. Public health experts point to major inflection points in the past four decades, the 1990s so-called welfare overhaul, the Great Recession, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, changes in the economy and family relationships, all which have clouded people's health. An accounting of the nation's health problems can start with the health system. The medical workforce is aging and stretched thin. The country desperately needs thousands more primary care doctors. The incentives for private companies are stacked on the treatment side rather than the prevention side. Policy proposals to change things often run into a buzzsaw of special interests. Healthcare is the only business that doesn't reward for quality care. All we reward for is volume. Do more, and you're going to get more money. Elizabeth Bradley, president of Vassar College and co-author of The American Healthcare Paradox, said if the nation's life expectancy crisis could be solved by the discovery of drugs, it would be a hot topic. But it's not, she said, because you would have to look at everything, the tax code, the education system. It's too controversial. Most politicians don't want to open Pandora's box. Yep, if you want to get to the heart of the issue, you're going to have to seriously look at social determinants, which gets at the very fabric of our society. That's what this show is about. Okay, well, our next story is a follow-up piece in that Washington Post study, How Red State Politics Are Shaving Years Off American Lives. And this is of particular interest to us Ohioans because it compares Ashtabula, Ohio, with other areas with similar demographics and shows that Ohio, as a deeply red state, has problems. This from the Washington Post. How red state politics are shaving years off American lives. Ashtabula's problems are Ohio's problems, and in large part, America's problems. Americans are more likely to die before age 65 than residents of similar nations, despite living in a country that spends substantially more per person on health care than its peers. Many of those early deaths can be traced to decisions made years ago by local and state lawmakers over whether to implement cigarette taxes, invest in public health, or tighten seatbelt regulations, among other policies, an examination by the Washington Post found. States' politics and their resulting policies are shaving years off Americans' lives. Ashtabula's problems stand out compared with two nearby counties, Erie, Pennsylvania, and Chautauqua, New York. All three communities, which ring picturesque Lake Erie and are a short drive from each other, have struggled economically in recent decades as industrial jobs withered, conditions that contribute towards rising midlife mortality, research shows. None is a success story when it comes to health, but Ashtabula residents are much more likely to die young, especially from smoking, diabetes-related complications, or motor vehicle accidents than people living in its sister counties in Pennsylvania and New York, states that have adopted more stringent public health measures. That pattern held true during the coronavirus pandemic, when Ashtabula residents died of COVID at far higher rates than people in Chautauqua and Erie. The differences around Lake Erie reflect a steady national shift in how public health decisions are being made and who's making them. State lawmakers gained autonomy over how to spend federal safety net dollars following Republican President Ronald Reagan's push to empower the states in the 80s. Those investments began to diverge sharply among red and blue lines, with conservative lawmakers often balking at public health initiatives they said cost too much or overstepped. Today, people in the South and Midwest, regions largely controlled by Republican state legislators, have increasingly higher chances of dying prematurely compared to those in the more Democratic Northeast and West, according to the Post analysis of death rates. The differences in states' policies directly correlate to those years lost, said Jennifer Karras Montes, director of the Center for Aging and Policy Studies at Syracuse University, and author of several papers that describe the connection between politics and life expectancy. Ohio sticks out, for all the wrong reasons. Roughly 1 in 5 Ohioans will die before they turn 65, according to Montes' analysis using the state's 2019 death rates. The state, whose legislature has been increasingly dominated by Republicans, has plummeted nationally when it comes to life expectancy rates, moving from middle of the pack to the bottom fifth of states during the last 15 years. Ohioans have a similar life expectancy to residents of Slovakia and Ecuador, relatively poor countries. Like other hard-hit Midwestern counties, Ashtabula has seen a rise in what are known as deaths of despair, drug overdoses, alcoholism, and suicides, prompting federal and state attention in recent years. But here, as well as in most counties across the United States, those types of deaths are far outnumbered by deaths caused by cardiovascular disease, diabetes, smoking-related cancers, and other health issues for residents between ages 35 and 64 years old. Between 2015 and 2019, nearly five times as many Ashtabula residents in their prime died of chronic medical conditions as died of overdoses, suicide, and all other external causes combined, according to the post-analysis of the CDC's death records. Public health officials say Ohio could save lives by adopting measures such as a higher tobacco tax or stricter seatbelt rules, initiatives supported by Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican generally friendly to their cause. I told the legislature, I'm going to ask you to invest in things where you're not going to see the results during your term in office, and I'm not going to see it during my term in office, DeWine said in an interview in the governor's mansion. But those proposals have repeatedly stalled in the state legislature controlled by Republicans for 27 of the past 29 years, and whose leaders show little inclination to move aggressively now. DeWine has a nanny state mentality, said Ohio State Representative Bill Seitz, the state House majority floor leader and fellow Republican who has helped block tobacco tax increases and aggressively lobby amid aggressive lobbying by industry interests. The 68-year-old Seitz, who smoked for 50 years before developing kidney cancer and having a kidney removed this summer, said he's unmoved by his own brush with the health system, even if it led him to finally kick the habit. I'm not going to turn into a smoke Nazi just because I used to smoke and I don't anymore, Seitz said. How Ohio fell behind. Cigarette taxes are $1.60 per pack in Ohio, $2.60 in Pennsylvania, and $5.35 per pack in New York. 30 years ago, Ohio's health outcomes were on par with California's. I'm going to say that again. 30 years ago, Ohio's health outcomes were on par with California's, with nearly identical rates for adults in the prime of life, ranking in the middle among the 50 states. But the two states' outcomes have diverged, along with their political leanings, said Ellen Miera, a health economics and policy professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. She has studied why death rates fell in California, home to some of the nation's most progressive politics, while they scarcely budged in increasingly conservative Ohio. By 2017, California had the nation's second lowest mortality rates, falling behind only Minnesota. Ohio ranked 41st. Health disparities also showed up unevenly across Ohio. The gleaming towers of the Cleveland Clinic, acclaimed as one of the world's top hospitals, stands an hour away from Ashtabula, where the average life expectancy in 2018 was 75.1 years, nearly 2 years lower than the state of Ohio's average, and more than 3.5 years shorter than the country's average. We have some of the most celebrated healthcare institutions not only in the nation, but in the world, said Dan Skinner, an associate professor of health policy at Ohio University, and yet it's not the difference maker in our health. Many of the state's public health outcomes are a direct result of political decisions, Skinner and other experts say, pointing to differences in Medicaid and safety net funding, as well as tobacco taxes and highway safety laws between Ohio and its neighbors. They note that Republicans' stranglehold on the legislature, after defying repeated court orders to withdraw state voting maps, has protected those politicians from the consequences of their votes. For example, the Ohio State Highway Patrol said about 500 people lose their lives every year in motor vehicle injuries in which those killed were not wearing seatbelts, a problem that has outraged groups such as the Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, as well as a 76-year-old governor who has spent decades pushing to improve motor vehicle safety. DeWine lost his 22-year-old daughter, Becky, to a car accident in 1993. Our job, it seems to me, is to do everything we can to spare families the tragedy of losing someone, losing a child, losing a loved one, DeWine said. But House Republicans in April blocked DeWine's proposal to allow police officers to pull over cars when they see drivers or their passengers not wearing seatbelts. In contrast, New York, in 1984, became the first state to enact such a law, followed by 34 other states. State data shows that seatbelt use has fallen in Ohio to the lowest level in 18 years, with fewer than 81% of residents regularly bucking up, compared to 92% of Americans as a whole. And I'll reverse that little number, so that means 19% of Ohioans are not bucking up regularly, compared to only 8% of Americans as a whole. This is worrying officials, who say the decline is preventable, inexplicable, and contributes to greater risk. A post-analysis shows that Ashtabula residents are twice as likely to die of motor vehicle injuries as are people in Chautauqua. Ohio's GOP lawmakers have also rebuffed multiple efforts to boost cigarette taxes, a public health measure proven to decrease smoking rates, especially among new and young smokers. When Governor John Kasich attempted to raise the cigarette tax by 65 cents per pack in 2017, business lobbyists warned that residents would spend their money elsewhere, with one testifying that consumers are coming into Ohio to save money on their cigarettes from Pennsylvania. The tax increase was defeated. Today, cigarettes in Ohio are notably cheaper than the same pack sold just over the state line. A Post reporter in June purchased Marlboro Gold, formerly called Marlboro Lights, among the most popular cigarettes for $9.74 in Ashtabula, $10.35 in Erie, and $13 in Chautauqua, the only place where the reporter was required to prove she was at least 21 years old. At the time, cigarette taxes were $1.60 per pack in Ohio, $2.66 in Pennsylvania, and $4.35 in New York. Now, I said $5.35 earlier. I'm not sure. One of those is probably wrong, but it's a lot more. In September, New York, which already boasts one of the highest state cigarette taxes in the nation, raised its tax another $1 per pack. Oh, so that was from before. It was $4.35 then. Now it's $5.35. Not surprisingly, experts said, Ohio's smoking rate exceeds that of nearby states with stricter tobacco measures. Almost 21% of adults in Ohio smoked in 2019, compared with 17% of Pennsylvanians and nearly 13% of New Yorkers, according to the CDC. There's also a notable difference in health outcomes. Smoking-related deaths, including from lung cancer, heart disease, and chronic lower respiratory disease, have declined sharply across the country over the last two decades, but increase in Ashtabula, where middle-aged adults are 55% more likely to die of those causes than the national average. While the rates of smoking-related deaths in Erie and Chautauqua are grim, they're not nearly as bad as Ashtabula's. As nearby states have shown more progress in curbing smoking, Ohio lawmakers have struggled to prioritize tobacco control, a decision telegraphed by how the state has spent billions of dollars from a landmark national settlement with cigarette companies in 1998. That windfall initially led to the creation of a Tobacco Prevention Foundation, ad campaigns to warn against smoking, and other initiatives helping users to quit. By 2005, Ohio was spending nearly $55 million that year on tobacco prevention-related activities, close to the CDC's recommended annual levels. Public health advocates said that strategy was clearly working. Ohio's adult smoking rate fell by more than one quarter between 2001 and 2008, among the steepest declines in the nation. And I also want to point out that Ohio was actually ahead of the pack in putting more money towards tobacco prevention than other states, but there was a quick reversal. But even as state smoking rates fell, advocates repeatedly warned that lawmakers were raiding the tobacco fund to pay for other priorities. When the global economic downturn hit the state in 2008, sparking layoffs and a government budget crunch, Ohio Democratic Governor Ted Strickland and the GOP-led legislature took an additional $230 million in settlement funds to prop up other programs, arguing that the money was needed to save jobs and keep employers afloat. That move, which gutted tobacco prevention efforts, including the foundation, sparked a legal battle and prompted public health experts such as a Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids to warn that state residents would pay the price for repurposing the funds. By 2010, Ohio was one of just three states not spending any settlement money on tobacco prevention, according to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. The state received $1.2 billion from the tobacco settlement that year, directing the money instead towards initiatives such as building schools and funding children's health care, as well as shoring up the state budget. Lawmakers' decision to shift money away from public health and toward other investments was devastating, said Amy Rowling McGee, president of the Health Policy Institute of Ohio, adding that the loss of the Tobacco Prevention Foundation made it harder to coordinate a statewide strategy. Those dollars provide an infrastructure that we no longer have. But ex-Governor Strickland stands by his handling of the tobacco fund, adding that the recession forced difficult trade-offs. Quote, in retrospect, I feel pretty damn good about what we did with those monies, the former governor said. There is a lot of kids that are healthier today because they have a school with a cafeteria. Well, that may be of some value, but the opportunity cost, the alternative, would have been much better for Ohioans' health. Meanwhile, Ohio's adult smoking rate rebounded, rising from 20% in 2008 to 25% in 2011, according to the CDC. The state now has one of the highest smoking rates in the country. Fight at the State House. Sitting in her office across the state capitol in Columbus, one influential lobbyist rallied against the harmful health effects of cigarettes. "Nobody wants to smoke. I don't smoke," said Beth Weimer, executive director of the Ohio Wholesale Marketers Association. But as chief lobbyist for dozens of wholesalers, businesses that purchase cigarettes, sports drinks, and other low-cost consumer products and then resell them to retailers across the Midwest, Weimer has repeatedly blocked efforts to raise the state tobacco tax during her 25-year career. Victory she won by arguing that increased cigarette prices would wreak economic havoc on small businesses. Ohio's tobacco tax has been raised just once since 2005. Public health experts say the state's relatively low tobacco tax is a key reason it had the fourth highest adult smoking rate in the country and ranked near the bottom of states for life expectancy as of 2019. In contrast, Pennsylvania's middle-of-the-pack smoking rate matched this life expectancy ranking, and New York, whose cigarette tax is now more than three times that of Ohio's, has one of the lowest smoking rates and ranked third in life expectancy. Research shows us that the higher the tax increase, the greater the impact on tobacco use. Amy Bush Stevens, a former leader of the Health Policy Institute of Ohio, testified to the state Senate's Finance Committee in June 2015 after Kasich tried to raise the state tobacco tax by $1 per pack. Public health advocacy groups like the American Lung Association had called for a $1.50 hike, arguing that the money was needed to rebuild tobacco prevention programs gutted by the redirection of tobacco settlement funding. Weimer brushes off those arguments, saying she has a job to do. Stop tobacco tax increases. I'm representing the businesses that are selling these products. The tobacco lobbyists have champions in the State House, such as Seitz, the House Majority Floor Leader, who smoked for half a century and framed the habit as a quality of life issue. "It's a free society, folks," he said. Seitz also argued that smokers are being wrongly targeted for extra taxes because they're a shrinking population and are, quote, easy to pick on. Public health experts in Ohio lament that they are outgunned by Big Tobacco and its coalition of convenience stores and other business owners fighting tax hikes on the grounds that they would cost jobs and raise prices. Rob Crane, a family medicine physician and anti-smoking advocate, said losses in the Ohio legislature despite clear evidence regarding the harmful health effects of smoking left him scratching my head. Until he learned that more than two dozen lobbyists had worked to defeat efforts to raise the legal age to buy cigarettes in the late 1990s, it was just an eye-opener to the level of participation by the tobacco industry in the state legislature, said Crane, who founded a national group that successfully fought to raise the minimum age for tobacco and nicotine sales in the United States to 21 in 2019. That might be the might of the tobacco lobby was also crucial in defeating Kasich's push for a higher tobacco tax in the 2010s, said Greg Moody, who coordinated that effort. Several Democrats described how their party's own attempts to raise tobacco taxes stalled out in the GOP-dominated legislature. DeWine said he's open to raising the tobacco tax, but in an interview, the career politician stressed that he's a pragmatist. He doesn't think it would have a chance at passing. "I don't propose things where I don't think I can get them done," the Ohio governor said. Different investments across state lines. When public health experts look across the state line from Ashtabula, they see a refracted mirror. Similar problems in the Pennsylvania and New York counties ringing Lake Erie, but somewhat better outcomes, in part because of the choices state politicians made. Erie County, which sits to the northeast of Ashtabula, appears to be benefiting from some of Pennsylvania's more aggressive policies towards smoking cessation. Pennsylvania has spent nearly 15% more on tobacco prevention than Ohio during the past 5 years, according to the American Lung Association, in addition to taxing cigarettes at a higher level than Ohio. Erie's smoking rate has declined by nearly one quarter since 2007, the year the state first awarded the county a tobacco control contract. The grant has paid to deploy anti-smoking educators to schools and workplaces and set up smoking cessation programs across northwestern Pennsylvania. According to CDC estimates, 20% of adults in Erie smoked in 2020, compared with 27% of adults in Ashtabula. Living in a border county, Erie officials know some of their residents will cross state lines for cheaper cigarettes. "We advocate for things that we're going to to make not smoking the easier choice, like increasing tobacco taxes, said Alexander Whipple, Director of Health Promotion and Quality Improvement for Erie County's Public Health Department. But people are still going to go to great lengths. Tobacco use is a very serious addiction. The troubles in Chautauqua, the next county over, are also clear and familiar. Boarded up houses, tales of frequent overdoses, empty buildings downtown. The county ranks among the lowest in New York for health outcomes. But compared with Ashtabula residents, people in Chautauqua are 20% less likely to die before age 65, according to the post-analysis of the latest death rates. That's in part because New York spent an average of $102 per person on public health annually in the years before the pandemic, more than double the $43 per person that Ohio spent, according to the Associated Press Health News Analysis. Elizabeth Kidder, a Chautauqua native who serves as medical director of a safety net clinic, has seen how state policies can have a direct impact on county residents. The internal medicine specialist said her patients who move out of state often find they don't have the same quality of Medicaid services. They call and complain that they can't get easy access to free transportation to the doctor. They don't realize how good they have it with the coverage that Medicaid offers in New York State, she said. Liberty versus life. In Ohio, as much as America, the fate of measures that can save lives boils down to a familiar tension, individualism versus public good. Christine Hill, health commissioner for Ashtabula City, said some constituents have urged her to get government out of their health care. She has even heard the argument at home. When Ohio debated an indoor smoking ban in the mid-2000s, that ultimately passed, she and her husband landed on opposite sides and planted dueling signs on either side of their driveway. Her husband doesn't even smoke, Hill said, but, quote, he doesn't want the government to tell him what to do. Hill had previously pushed the city council to pass an ordinance in 2002 to fine businesses that sell cigarettes to underage customers. But the city's ordinance is one that the Ohio legislature was looking to strip when Seitz and his colleagues passed a bill last year preventing cities from imposing stricter tobacco regulations. Before DeWine vetoed the legislation in January and nixed a similar measure in July. To health advocates and the legislatures, the fight over what's known as preemption, state lawmakers passing legislation to stop local governments from implementing policies such as harsher cigarette taxes or stricter gun laws, is part of the existential battle over the direction of the state. Republican lawmakers have increasingly deployed preemption laws to hamstring the ability of cities and counties to make health mandates that could have some residents, according to legal experts. But from DeWine's perspective, government is essential to protecting the public. As a Republican governor, former member of Congress, and former Ohio Attorney General, he has pushed for measures such as stricter seatbelt laws, poison control hotlines, tighter coronavirus restrictions, and protecting opioid settlement money, sometimes in opposition to his own party. I think that one of the central functions of government is to preserve life, DeWine said. A photo that's more than 30 years old sticks out among the myriad family pictures displayed throughout the home. The DeWines gathered around a nativity scene in their kitchen. It was the last Christmas they were all together before Becky's fatal car accident. DeWine's personal philosophy on weighing public health versus personal freedom is also shaped by that loss. That tragedy, said, focuses you on what matters in life. The governor acknowledged he has much to do in his remaining 3 years in office. He said he plans to focus on what we all know will lengthen life, what we know will give people the opportunity to live up to their potential, such as prenatal and postnatal care, early childhood education, and other measures targeting Ohio's youngest residents. Much of his efforts, he said, will not pay off in his political lifetime. So I suppose I'll like just end with a little bit of commentary on that life versus liberty. Our health-related quality of years of life is very much correlated with our own personal liberty. You know, having your health destroyed by cardiovascular, respiratory disease, or cancer by smoking cigarettes is hardly a great boon for freedom. And I would argue that nicotine, one of the most addictive substances on earth, having a nicotine addiction that keeps you with a really nasty habit is hardly a great signature for freedom as well. Well, my friends, this is Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, this next much shorter story does tie in with the last large study by Washington Post. This is from CBS News. Child gun deaths and fatal drug poisoning skyrocketed over past decade, researchers find. Fatal injury rates have spiked over the past decade for children and teens in the U.S., especially deaths involving guns and drugs, according to new research published in the journal Pediatrics. Injury data for children under age 18 from 2011 to 2021 from the CDC allowed researchers to find that firearm fatalities increased by 87% during that time period. Drug poisoning fatalities increased by 133%, and suffocation-related fatalities increased by 13%. Recent trends in pediatric injury-related fatalities are alarming, with increases in homicides, suicides, and poisonings in the past decade, the authors write. Non-fatal firearm and poison-related injuries also increased, up 113% and 10% respectively. At the same time, the rate of non-fatal injuries within the same age group decreased in several other categories from 2011 to 2020, including a 53% decline in injuries from falls and a 47% decrease in motor vehicle occupant injuries. Injuries from drowning stayed about the same. The divergent trend between fatal and non-fatal injuries highlights the need for a comprehensive approach to childhood injury prevention, the study notes. The authors credit the decrease in non-fatal car injuries, for example, to public health interventions targeting pediatric safety, technological advancements, and legislative requirements. But the opposite is the case for firearms and drug poisonings. Despite the progress in reducing most non-fatal injuries, the trends in increasing non-fatal firearm and poisoning injuries defies the overall trend in non-fatal injuries, in part because public health legislative support has lagged these critical injury mechanisms, they write. This is especially concerning given the high case fatality rate of these injury mechanisms in children. So there you go. The environment that we live in legislatively, public health policy matters, saving lives and reducing the burden of injuries. Okay, well, next up we have a story that also gets at some of the red-blue divide in our culture. This from the San Francisco Chronicle. Violence dropped in California, but was high for this group. The fourth annual California Violence Experiences Survey was conducted from March to May. It found that 1 in 20 adults surveyed reported experiencing physical violence in the past year. About 1 in 10 of the study's more than 3,500 respondents experienced sexual harassment or assault in the last year. Trans or binary people, which the 2023 study tracked for the first time, reported higher rates of victimization than cisgender people across those categories. Transgender adults reported a sevenfold higher rate of physical violence compared to cisgender respondents, and both trans and non-binary respondents experienced five times the rate of sexual harassment and assault. More than half of cisgender women also reported experiencing intimate partner violence at some point in their life, the study found. While that number was 76% for non-binary people and 83% for transgender people. So, intimate partner violence is very prevalent in a lifetime experience among all women, and even more so for non-binary people and transgender folks. Okay, well, next up, a study from Physicians for National for a Health Program that gets at one of the reasons our for-profit healthcare system doesn't work very well. Medicare Advantage plans overcharge 22 to 35%. Commercial insurance companies exist for one reason and one reason only, to make money. Corporate entities like Humana and United Healthcare have become experts at charging as much as they can, paying out as little as possible for medical care, and pocketing the rest. These practices extend to the so-called Medicare Advantage program, where corporate health insurers have established a pattern of overcharging patients. Physicians for National Health Program has just published a groundbreaking report developed by our policy committee and reviewed by independent health policy experts that quantifies the extent of these overpayments. We estimate that Medicare Advantage plans overcharge taxpayers by a minimum of 22% or $88 billion each year, and potentially by up to 35% or $140 billion per year. This is money that can and should be spent on patient care, but is instead lining the pockets of shareholders and executives. By eliminating overpayments in Medicare Advantage, we could make substantial improvements to our existing public health programs. Our low-end estimate of $88 billion per year in overcharges would cover dental, vision, and hearing benefits for everybody on traditional Medicare and for everybody on Medicaid. Our high-end estimate of $140 billion per year would totally eliminate premiums for Medicare Part B. That's kind of your Medigap plans. Lots of profits, less healthcare. Okay, let's turn to a little bit of better news. This from the Nation's Health, publication of the American Public Health Association. EPA moving to ban more harmful chemicals after toxics law overhaul. The EPA is identifying and evaluating the first of 10 chemicals for safety after a 2016 overhaul of the 1976 Toxic Substance Control Act. While the act previously focused mainly on the cost of regulating chemicals, the 2016 update mandated the EPA to account for the health of workers as well as vulnerable people such as children, pregnant women, and older adults who live near chemical manufacturers. At least 9 of the 10 chemicals they chose are one people have been concerned about and have been trying to get the EPA to ban for years, said Daniel Rosenberg, director of federal toxics policy at the National Research Defense Council. Those are high-volume chemicals that people have been concerned about for decades. It's taken a while to get going. EPA officials admit that having enough staff to complete risk evaluations for existing and new chemicals in a timely fashion is an ongoing issue. The process to evaluate an existing chemical is a multi-year effort from prioritization to risk management. For new chemicals, prior to the amended Toxic Substance Control Act, EPA conducted risk evaluations on only 20% of new chemicals versus 100% of them today, said Shari Barash, acting director of the EPA's New Chemicals Division. The agency receives about 500 submissions annually from manufacturers for new chemicals. In that way, it's a fivefold increase without commensurate resources, Barash told the Nation's Health. So that's one of the things we've been challenged with. With EPA's progress sometimes held up in legal, political, and bureaucratic limbo, state legislators have jumped in to ban or restrict the use of harmful chemicals. There are over 300 laws in nearly 40 states that address the effects of harmful chemicals, according to Safer States, an organization of state-based groups advocating for chemical safety policies. Retailers have also played a role. Stores such as Lowe's, Home Depot, and Sherwin-Williams remove products containing methylene chloride from their shelves thanks to pressure from groups such as the National Resource Defense Council and Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families. So, it's good to get the federal government to do it, but in lieu of that, we have to go to the states and even putting pressure on retailers. Okay, want to close our regular reporting about something about the health benefits of awe. This from Medical Express. Awe-inspiring science can have positive effect on mental well-being, research finds. Research led by psychologists at the University of Warwick have revealed a profound connection between the spirituality of science and positive well-being, much like the benefits traditionally associated with religion. People with greater feelings of spirituality of science were more positively engaged with science material, which predicted better science performance. And in a group of atheists and agnostics, spirituality of science predicted measures of well-being and meaning in life, paralleling the positive effects of religion that is frequently observed in religious people. So awe is something that transcends religious belief. Okay, well that brings us to our closing segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 15 stories up this week. Number one, dengue will take off in Southern Europe, U.S., Africa this decade, WHO scientists said. So you might have heard of dengue fever, something that's common in tropical and subtropical areas, but they're moving north due to climate change. And bonus article two, why dengue in Europe could spell disaster for the rest of the world. Increase investment into previously neglected diseases could see poor countries left behind. Just like we saw with the COVID pandemic, hoarding of vaccines and such can often leave poor countries worse off. And in a related story, bonus article three, how a big pharma company stalled a potentially life-saving vaccine in pursuit of bigger profits. No surprise there. Bonus article four, we know how to regulate new drugs and medical devices, but we're about to let healthcare AI run amok. So, we know how to do it, doesn't necessarily mean we'll do it, and even when we have, the regulations are not always in force. Article 5, industry ties could muddy U.S. dietary guidelines, Watchdog says. So this is about determining the U.S. Dietary guidelines that they do every like 10 years. Bonus Article 6, nursing schools are turning away thousands of applicants during a major nursing shortage. Here's why. partly because there's a shortage of nursing professors, nursing clinical instructors. They're not paying those folks enough, and they're going to do other jobs rather than teaching for one reason. Article 7, Medicare's proposal on nursing home staff meets insane impasse between huge profits and poor staffing and wages. So it 80% of nursing homes don't meet the new proposed guidelines or requirements for staffing of nursing homes. But there is huge profits in nursing home care, and there's also very poor staffing and low wages. Why don't we put those two together and get better staffing and better wages? Bonus Article 8, language services, a legal right in healthcare, but often not a reality. Many healthcare settings and hospitals don't have adequate language services for those that need them. Bonus Article 9, as conservative views collide with science, doctors find themselves navigating political landmines. So this is a lot of abortion and gender care stuff. And a related story, 10, Idaho banned abortion, then it turned down supports for pregnancy and birth. So much for pro-life. Bonus Article 11, they just tried to scare us. How anti-abortion centers teach sex ed inside public schools. Another conservative sham. Bonus Article 12, severity of RSV hospitalizations rivals COVID in older adults. So COVID still kills more people, but when somebody is hospitalized, RSV is just as dangerous as COVID in older adults. Bonus Article 13, Walgreens walkout. Your pharmacy might be closed this week. So there's labor troubles in the pharmacy area. Bonus Article 14, how borrowing medical debt from credit scores could impact borrowers. A good story giving the overviews of how that will work. Of course, that medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country still today, as it has been for many years. And a good ending article, Bonus Article 15, Cleveland accelerates its ambitions for hitting net zero energy. Climate change is a public health issue, and if you want to see how one city deals with these goals and the challenges, this is a good article. You can view these and all the other articles I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-